You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. And joining us today on Perspectives is award-winning journalist Michael Moss. He is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. Michael was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for exploratory reporting in 2010 on uncontaminated meat, and he was a finalist for the prize in 2006 and 1999. And his latest book is called Salt, Sugar, Fat. And those are three words that I'm sure that we're all very familiar with. It's a situation that we've been dealing with here in El Paso for a long time, as far as not just salt, sugar, and fat, but the fact that obesity is a problem. And here in El Paso, childhood obesity rates in the United States, 17% of children in El Paso are overweight, and that is a huge number. And now here in the United States, we have 26 million Americans who now have diabetes. So, Michael, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as I mentioned, the name of the book is Salt, Sugar, Fat. And what Michael did, he kind of went behind the scenes and decided to take a tour of some of the companies that, some of the giants, actually, the fast food giants like Kraft, Coca-Cola, Kellogg's, bunch of other ones. And this is a result as of a 1999 meeting, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, where the CEOs of all these companies got together and they decided that they needed to do something to fight the obesity.
The book starts with this incredible meeting, a private meeting among CEOs of some of the largest companies in 1999. They were assembled to consider the then looming obesity crisis. And what was stunning about it was that one of their own, a senior executive at Kraft, stood up, gave a presentation, and basically laid the entire obesity crisis at their feet and pleaded with them to accept responsibility, at least for some of the problem, and to hold themselves accountable for coming up with the solution. He was asking the food companies to collectively get together and do something to turn the corner on obesity.
And, of course, we all know that money talks, and not only does it talk, it screams. And sometimes that's what people are looking at. They're not looking at how are we doing health-wise, etc. Who's buying the product? And when the CEO for Kraft got up and talked to all his peers, what was the reaction? I would imagine that this was kind of, wait a minute, what are you talking about?
Yeah, the CEOs were very defensive. I mean, they felt that they were already being incredibly responsible to both their shareholders and to consumers by offering low-fat products, low-sugar products. Hey, whatever you want, we'll put it out there and you can choose to buy that. And they also were looking at basically the fear of losing millions of dollars in revenues, because their bottom line has always been, we need to offer people the best tasting products that we can. And so the meeting ended without the companies doing anything. And dial forward 14, 15 years now, you're starting to see huge increased amounts of consumer concern about what we're all putting into our bodies. And I think the companies are really starting to feel the pressure now, and probably some of them regret that they didn't act more forcefully way back when they had the opportunity.
For the benefit of our audience, this meeting that they held was not because of pressure that they were receiving, right? This was something that Mr. Mudd decided they needed to address on their own?
Extraordinary is that internally at many of these companies, not just Kraft, there were senior officials, many of them scientists, others marketing, brilliant marketing people, warriors for the companies, who became concerned about the very icons that they had helped develop. Some of them in a more innocent era. Jell-O, as you mentioned, even the Lunchables, things going back to the early 80s were conceived of at a time when our dependence on convenience processed foods was not what it is today. And these insiders at these companies began pushing their bosses to reconsider their incredible dependence on using salt, sugar, fat in big amounts as the pillars of processed foods.
Interestingly, what we're talking about, you're talking about convenience and the fact that, you know, the Lunchables are a big, big success because they're easy to grab, easy to, you know, throw in a bag or in the kid's backpack. But at the same time, they have a lot of these additives that you talk about in your book.
And there's also huge psychological marketing that went into Lunchables. They first targeted them at mothers who worked outside the home, having interviewed mothers and having heard this nightmarish 7 a.m. scene in the house where everybody's scrambling to get out of the room. The reaction of the Lunchable inventors was, wow, what a gold mine of problems and opportunities is this. And when they first targeted the Lunchables to mom, it was almost creating the Lunchables as a gift to their children, maybe even to help alleviate some of the guilt of working outside of the home. But then they turned to the kids, and they came up with something called pizza Lunchables, which every mother in the country thought their kids would just totally reject. I mean, think about it. It's a cold piece of pizza dough with some cold cheese and some cold tomato sauce that the kid has to put together on the lunchroom counter. And yet, what they found out is that kids went head over heels for them because it wasn't about the food, it was about the empowerment. And Kraft came up with the slogan, all day you got to do what they say, but lunchtime is all yours. And Lunchables became a humongous hit for Kraft. And Lunchables, in a way, became sort of a gateway food for the fast food industry to move into the grocery stores. The grocery manufacturers saw that they could sell more product by competing not only with each other for space on the grocery shelf, but with the fast food chains. And that's why, with Lunchables, for example, you saw them morph into hot dog Lunchables and hamburger Lunchables, pancake Lunchables, the maxed out line of Lunchables, and on and on. And increasingly, you're seeing these highly processed, highly convenient, super loaded with salt, sugar, and fat products in the grocery store.
When we talk about that meeting that the CEOs, Mr. Mudd was looking for some help from his buddies at the other companies. And what I mean by help, and I'm talking about financial help so they could all come up together. And he was shooting for a goal of something like $15 million or something, and he was short.
A drop in the bucket. I think they came up with maybe $3 or $4 million, mostly from Kraft itself. It was very disappointing to the executives who were trying to get the food industry to collectively start fighting obesity, and something really happened. Kraft was convinced it was on the right track, and Mudd went back to Kraft and convinced his bosses that Kraft should go ahead and set out on its own. And that's another remarkable chapter in the book, because Kraft did that. It cut back on its marketing of the most sugary foods to kids. It rejiggered its package labeling so it more fully disclosed the number of calories and fat and sugar in the packages, and not just per tiny little serving, because most of us, as Kraft knew, you know, couldn't resist eating the whole bag when we sat down and opened it up. And most incredibly, they told their food inventors, their scientists, that they could no longer use as much sugar, salt, and fat as they wanted to make their products craveable. Kraft put caps. They limited the amount of those three ingredients, which was an incredible thing for a company to do.
As an investigative journalist, some people would think that you would go around, you know, sneaking around, but they invited you to go in there, and you actually tasted some of these foods without these added ingredients.
I did, and one of the reasons that they opened up to me was that I did come across a treasure trove of documents that were just sitting there in the open and hiding, if you will. These were documents that were collected in the state's litigation against tobacco companies, and the reason it was important to me in my research for this book is that Philip Morris owned Kraft for nearly as long as 20 years, through the beginnings of the obesity crisis. And in these 81 million pages of records were all these memos, strategy papers from Kraft, from the food division, to Philip Morris, discussing strategy that no one had ever really looked at before. And I used that documentation to really understand what was going on inside the companies, not as a got you, but really get the sense of how between a rock and a hard place really are they, and believe me, they are. So the visit that you mentioned, I went to Kellogg, and Kellogg prepared for me specially versions of some of their icons without any salt in them at all to show me and impress upon me how hooked the companies themselves are on salt, sugar, and fat. And I have to tell you, the saltless Cheez-Its, normally I can eat Cheez-Its day in and day out and never stop. I couldn't even swallow the ones without salt. They stuck to the roof of my mouth, and it really illustrated how salt is such a miracle ingredient for these companies. It does far more than just provide flavor burst, as the companies call the flavor of salt.
You talk about ingredients, and in your book you also mentioned that suddenly cheese has also become an ingredient in some of these foods.
Our consumption in this country of cheese has tripled since the 70s to as much as 33 pounds per person per year on average. And I was totally puzzled by that because I didn't think I was eating that much more cheese. And what happened over the years is that cheese deliberately got turned into something that we all used to eat merely as a delicacy, as an hors d'oeuvre before meal, to an ingredient in processed food. And it's added because it's amazingly alluring. They call it the mouthfeel of fat. And it's that warm, gooey sensation you get when you bite into a melting, toasted cheese sandwich that goes right to the pleasure center of your brain, which sends signals, Michael, boy, do we love that. Eat some more.
So when you come to the Southwest, if you stop in El Paso, Dennis and I will take you to eat some chile con queso.
Oh, I would so look forward to that. Look, it's about moderation. You know, this is not a book about anti-processed food. I have two young boys. We're dependent on processed foods and convenience foods as the rest of the country. It's about gaining control and understanding everything the food companies are throwing at you so you can walk in the grocery store and be in control of the situation and not get pulled this way and that way and get compelled to buy too much of things that you shouldn't.
We used to, when generic foods first came out, there was a white bag with black letters or a yellow bag with black letters. And then, of course, you had other companies coming up with their generic version of Chips Ahoy or whatever. Mm. Now, as far as the cereal goes, I know when I was in undergraduate school, I wrote a paper called Sugar in the Morning and talking about how these companies just push sugary cereals, you know, down the throats of our children. And, you know, children memorize these jingles, and you go down to the store and they sing it. I want this. I want that. Mm-hmm. You said something, I believe, about Apple Jacks, was it? And it was interesting what I thought about how the apple was looked at somewhat differently.
Even the marketing they've put in the cereals changes over the years, and they're always looking for an edge over competitors. And at one point, Kellogg decided that kids really weren't that wowed by apple taste in Apple Jacks, and yet there it was in the product. So they came up with this advertisement that had two cartoon characters. One was the cinnamon stick, which was basically a euphemism for the sugar in the cereal, and the other was a fresh apple, and they had a race. And the poor apple was fat, ugly, slow, stumbled, lost the race. And consumer advocates went crazy because they're trying to get kids to eat more fresh fruit, including whole sliced apples. And here was Kellogg in their eyes disparaging the apple. Kellogg said it really didn't mean to do that, but they pulled back on the advertising. And in the end, they allowed the apple to at least tie in the races. But that's an example of kind of the aggressive marketing that all the companies put into their products.
We're talking about healthy versus unhealthy, or it's almost like when you put that name or that brand on it, this is healthy for you. Let's say, for example, do you want a bran muffin or would you like a banana nut muffin? People are going to say, I'll take the banana nut muffin. Thank you very much. So as far as cookies, sweets, snacks, what about these healthy food places like Trader Joe's,
yeah, I mean, you know,
or Whole Foods?
One of the tricks I've learned in my family, and maybe it can help other people, is that the first thing to beware of when you go in the grocery store, we all kind of know to look at the nutrient label and the calorie content, but it's the front of the label. That's where you see the touting low fat, all natural, low sugar, low this, or added calcium. Those are the come-ons to buy the product, and they're certainly true, but so typically when you look at the ingredients and the nutrients, a low-fat yogurt is going to be loaded with sugar. You know, a low-sugar item is going to be loaded with fat, and a low-salt item is going to be loaded with both, and sometimes they increase the other ingredients to keep the taste at maximum levels. So, yeah, this whole idea that there are healthy versions of foods in the grocery store really begs the question, well, then what's the rest of it?
Good point. What about, you mentioned the military and how they were trying to come up with a type of food that, you know, would have the long shelf space, but at the same time would
really
taste
stuck,
good.
Yes. Yeah, they need foods that can last for 3 years.
And you mentioned the bliss point at that point, did you?
Well, yes. And legendary food scientist named Howard Moskowitz was working for the U.S. Army and looking at how he could increase the attraction to foods that necessarily had to sit on the shelf for 3 years. And mind you, you know, the military is a different problem. It needs its soldiers to eat more field when they're out in combat in the field, because the tendency is to not eat enough and you lose energy. And so Howard set about and helped perfect the formula and the science that became known as the bliss point, which was finding the perfect amount of sugar and then fat, and then salt and foods that would send us over the moon. He's a mathematician by training, and he is brilliant and helped create any number of icons in the grocery store using the perfect formulas.
As far as models go, adults also recognize the models, and there used to be, when Schlitz was out, I'm not sure if it's still out there, the beer, but they would say in the commercial, at Schlitz, we steam clean our bottles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, every brewery does that. But because Schlitz told you they did it, people thought, these are the only guys who do it. And
I
so
love how,
it's a catchphrase.
No, I was just going to say, I love how honest some of the advertising is, too. I mean, remember Frito-Lay and the slogan, bet you can't eat just one? they came up with that in an era when, again, you know, snack foods were much more innocent, and our dependence on them was much less. But today, that same slogan really tells you a lot, and the potato chip is so perfectly engineered to be craveable and addictive. It's certainly one of my favorites.
As far as addictive, and you said you can't eat more than just one, some of these restaurants and, also the fast food places and convenience stores have gone to free refills.
Yes. And in fact, as I discovered, it started with Coca-Cola. The former president of Coke North America, Latin America, walked me through the early genesis of the supersize phenomenon. Coke was one of the first companies that realized it could sell more Coke and help food chains sell more food if it offered free refills. And the reason that was cost effective was that, I mean, the ingredients themselves are a fraction of the value of what they're getting for the soda. So much of it is marketing and advertising. So you could give people two Cokes for marginally more expense than one.
And the numbers that you use in your book, I think on that formula or whatever they were talking about, I think it was that, 20% of the people using 80% of the product sounded
really,
very good.
Really good point. 20% of the people drinking Coke will typically drink 80% of the Coke that's consumed. And that's a ratio that you find across the board in consumer products and other things as well. And Coke referred to these customers, these are their best customers, and they refer to them not as consumers, as customers, but as heavy users. And so much of their marketing was targeted at the heavy users because it was much more cost effective for them to concentrate on holding those heavy user consumptions of Coke, and these are the people who drink as much as 3 cans a day, than it was to sort of edge up the consumption on the rest of the 80% that were drinking 20%.
The early diet sodas tasted awful. I remember Tab and Fresca, but now people prefer the diet drinks, so because they're zero calories, they think they can drink more of them.
Well, to their credit, the soda companies are putting out more products that are less calorie, zero calorie, even bottled water. There's a cautionary note at that, though, which is if you're concerned about weight maintenance or you're trying to lose weight, you know, nutritionists will tell you to be really careful with diet soda. because it can lull you into a false sense of security, so that you might drink a Diet Coke 1 minute, then, you know, eat that banana nut or bran muffin that you talked about the next, and you're going to get a load of calories from the muffin that you might not be calculating into your overall diet. You have to be really careful and not let yourself slip and think that just by drinking a diet soda, it's going to inoculate you to the rest of the calories you may be eating that day.
You talked earlier also about healthy shopping, and you mentioned that in your book. So why don't you kind of take us through a shopping trip? We walk into the grocery store, and they move stuff around on purpose so that you can know, try and figure out where is this, and you run into different things.
Yep. You know, one of the things you're taught in shopping is always make a list and stick to it so you don't make spontaneous decisions. Well, the grocers and the manufacturers do the opposite. They position things to encourage you to make spontaneous decisions, because that's when they can get your brain craving for the sweetest and the fattest products. And so sometimes they'll put the soda cooler right at the checkout counter. In fact, the checkout counter used to be just sort of gum and magazines, but now you find all kinds of snack foods being positioned at that place where you're going to grab at the last moment and not pay attention to it. It's kind of the first thing. The other thing is that, they put the healthier stuff, the fresh fruits, the vegetables, less processed meats, dairies, off to the side, and it's the main center aisles of the store where you're going to find the more problematic foods and the foods that more may compel you to overeat. So the other trick is spend more if you want to eat. If you want to shop more healthy, you spend more time on the outer aisles. Be careful when you go to the center aisles, and also be really careful at eye level in the center aisles, because the companies have done studies showing that our eyes tend to gravitate to the eye level shelf in the middle of the aisle, and that's where they place their biggest selling items, which almost invariably are the ones most loaded with salt, sugar, and fat.
People will go to the aisle, they'll put it in the basket, and then give it to their kids, give it to the family, whatever, but they don't know how to read labels.
It's really hard. And look, the government doesn't really help this as much as people might think. In fact, it wasn't until the late 80s, early 90s when labeling was required. Up until that point, we didn't know what was in food in terms of calorie and fat content and sugar. But sugar remains a real bone of contention, because, next time you pick up a product, look on the nutrient facts box and notice that it will tell you how much sugar is in the product, but it won't tell you how much of that sugar was added by the company and how much might be in there naturally to the fruit or the vegetable. It also won't give you a recommendation of the maximum amount of sugar to have in a day. So you really don't know how close you're getting to that limit. And believe me, at 70 pounds sugar a year on average for Americans, most of us are way over the recommended limit on sugar.
And as we talked about diabetes earlier, El Paso has a high incidence of diabetes.
Yes.
The fact that they pick up something that says no sugar added doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't any sugar.
That's right. Oh, that's another good point. If it says no sugar added, one of the things you're increasingly seeing in the grocery store is the word fruit, because it conveys a halo of health. And often, so often now, this fruit is something called fruit concentrate, which in its purest form is basically just essentially sugar. They've taken out the fiber and all the things that make fresh fruit so healthy. So that's one thing to be really aware of. Little fruit leather things have a whole chunk of aisle these days, which are meant to be in some ways a substitute for fresh fruit, but by no means are they. They're candy, they're sugar, and that's how they should be viewed, even though they have the name fruit on them.
And what about sugar substitutes like Splenda, Stevia, etc.?
I think that falls back into the diet. I mean, I looked at those only in the context, can eating diet foods really work to help you lose weight? And I think the guarded answer is yes, if, again, you don't put too much emphasis on those, or rather too much hope that they'll inoculate you in the rest of your diet. So you've got to maintain that strategy throughout the day and night, or you'll lose it. or gained it, as the case may be.
As far as the bottomless glasses that we talked about, sodas earlier, there are a lot of all-you-can-eat buffets. What about those? Is that kind of the same principle as the soda situation?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I know that I have trouble going into an all-you-can-eat buffet. I think instinctually all of us will eat more than we otherwise would. And people have done studies, too, showing that if you eat with a larger dinner plate, you're much more apt to eat more at dinner. Nutritionists have coined a term mindless eating. And the opposite of that is mindful eating. And I'm really hoping that this book helps people move from mindless eating to mindful eating, which just simply means paying more attention. My mom used to tell me when I was a kid, chew your food, Michael, slow down. And she explained to me that it takes time for your stomach to catch up to your brain, or your brain, rather, to catch up with your stomach and send those signals saying, hey, had enough, I'm full, Michael. And if you just wolf it down, not paying attention to it, boom, you're invariably going to eat more than you should.
One of the other things that you mentioned earlier also about trying to stay healthy is the fact that a lot of people were going to the low-fat milk or almond milk, soy milk, coconut milk, etc.
Yeah, and one of the things that happened when people went to low-fat milk starting in the 60s, and really low-fat milk, the 1%, not the 2%, and skim milk, is that the dairy industry was left with a glut of whole-fat milk and milk fat that was extracted from the whole-fat milk to make the low-fat versions. They started turning that into butter, ice cream, and cheese. And that helps explain why cheese consumption has soared in this country, because with help from the government, they began marketing that cheese, again, not as a delicacy that you would eat for itself before meals as an hors d'oeuvre, but as an ingredient in foods to increase the allure. And so in the grocery store now, you see cheese as an additive all over the place.
One of the things that I was going to ask you about is, because you are an investigative journalist, and you know that as a journalist, sometimes you eat when you can eat, and you grab whatever it is, and you don't look at what you just ate was a serving size for four people.
Yeah, and I think one of the keys to this is sort of develop habit. I mean, it takes a little time up front to, you know, pick your favorite food, stop, look at the label, figure out how much is in there. But once you get kind of a routine on that, then it takes much less time than you think. And you can even, as I say, you can get in a positive, healthy habit. You know how many potato chips you can eat, you know, and what your cap should be. And again, knowing everything that the food companies throw at you to get you to eat more is really empowering in the end.
Michael, thank you very much for joining us today. We've been visiting with investigative journalist, also Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Moss. The name of the book is Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, and it's available online at Amazon. And is it as available as an ebook or a Kindle book as well?
Ebook. Kindle does a fantastic audiobook that's been designed, and I hope every local bookstore will be carrying it for you.
Michael, thank you very much again for being with us today, and congratulations on your Pulitzer Prizes and also on your nominations.
Thanks for having me.
Perspectives is taped and produced at KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.